Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay. Today we are talking about Stranger Things, the TV show that began in 2016, created by Matt Duffer and Ross Duffer. I'm joined by the Lessons from Screenplay team, Trisha Rand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello, hello.
And Alex Kayatos.
Hi.
There's a lot of things to talk about with Stranger Things. Three seasons of lots of fun and adventures, and I'm curious to hear what all of our reactions are to all the different places that the show goes. And that's one of the things that I love about the show, is that it goes to so many places and does so many things. I was thinking earlier today about the first time I watched Stranger Things, and it was a kind of unlikely viewing for me, right? Because I hadn't heard about it, that it was coming out at all. And then it was just like people on Twitter and friends were like, have you seen Stranger Things? You should check it out. And I was like, okay, what's it about? And they're like, well, it's like the 80s. It's like all those 80s movies and like that style. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. But they were like, no, just shut up and watch it. Okay. And then I watched it and really, really enjoyed it. Super duper won me over. So yeah, I want to hear from you guys if you knew anything about it before watching it, or knew like what the format was going to be, because I feel like this is also one of the early entries into the Netflix series thing, and the idea of dropping all the episodes, binge, like this is meant to be binged in a very quick period of time. So yeah, I'm curious, like Trisha, did you know anything about this before it came out?
I actually can't remember. I definitely got on board the train like right away, basically, because I was a general fan of like Netflix shows at the time. I was a very big fan of the first couple seasons of House of Cards. And so I was like, oh, Netflix is going to do a cool new thing. And it checks a lot of my boxes because I like 80s movies. And so I was really excited. And also, it should be said, like, for all of its flaws, I actually do like Super 8 as well, which is very much doing you know, did the Stranger Things thing before the Duffers decided to go ahead and do it as well. But yeah, I just got on board with it right away, binged the entire first season right when it came out, did the same with the second and did the same with the third. And because the seasons are so short, it's like a really good match of like material and that idea of, yeah, drop the whole season at once. You know, the Duffers wanted this to be more like a movie. And dropping it all at one time creates that feeling where you can just kind of watch it as like a multi-part but long sort of cinematic experience. And it's great. Like, I have just so much to say about it. It's really great. It's just one of the more fun shows for us to get in the second half of the 2010s. It's really awesome that it's been as successful as it has been.
Yeah, I want to get into the sort of releasing things all at once thing later, after we've had some time to actually talk about Stranger Things first. But yeah, I was the same as you, Michael. Like, I didn't know what it was. I just kept seeing these two words pop up on social media. And it was kind of one of those things where I was like, I said this about Ozark a couple weeks ago, where I was like, I'm just going to press play on this thing. I'm not even going to look up what it is, just out of curiosity. So I actually thought it was going to be a Outer Limits, Twilight Zone style, like episodic anthology show. The first episode's called The Vanishing of Will Byers, which very much sounds like this is one episode about this one story, and then episode two will be about something else. Also, it's eight episodes, which feels short based on Netflix was doing 13 episode season episodes at the time. And then yeah, I threw on the first episode and was hooked right away. I mean, I'm a big fan of E.T., Goonies, Stand By Me, Poltergeist, like all stuff that I watched a bunch growing up. So I immediately got that's what it was going for. And just the story itself, it just does a really good job of hooking you into these characters and the story and the sort of mystery and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, big fan right away. And then yeah, same as you, Trisha, like season two, season three, just how soon can I watch it all? Okay, you know, have it all watched by noon today, done.
The July 4th weekend drop on season three was the move. It was really, really smart marketing and just smart everything.
My girlfriend and I we went out and got like Eggos and like kids snacks. So we had Eggo waffles for breakfast, and then we started at like noon, and then we had snacks during the day, and then we made like Hawkins Fair burgers for dinner. I made two craft cocktails, one called the Demogorgon and one called the Bloody Barb. Delicious.
Barb.
And then we watched the whole thing in one day, which meant like by the time we were on the last episode, like the finale, there were actual fireworks going on around us. It's so perfect.
I will also always associate season 3 with the huge earthquake that happened in LA.
That happened during the first episode that was released, for us.
Right. Because I remember I luckily paused the show and it happened during a pause because otherwise I would have been very confused for a decent amount of time.
Yeah.
Alex, what about you? What was your first experience with Stranger Things?
Like Trisha, I can't really remember, but I'm pretty sure I was one of the early adopters. Like, because I was also a big fan of House of Cards and Netflix, I was interested in whatever they were doing next. And yeah, probably the preview played on Netflix and I was like, I'm in. Show me this. And it was just, you know, season one especially was just so pleasurable from the very start. Like, it's very rare that a show from the very beginning is just so... I'm just enjoying every moment of it. There's no like ease in time for me with Stranger Things. Like other shows, it's like, well, be patient, like give it a few episodes. It's going to get better. Like it's going to become the thing that it is, like slog through. None of that with Stranger Things. I'm hooked in and I'm enjoying every minute of it from the first episode. And so that was just a really rare experience and was such a wonderful surprise when I first watched it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, and that's, you know, why we wanted to talk about the pilot, because the pilot is so great at setting up all these things so quickly and hooking you in and also showing you the spectrum of places that it's going to go. Like, it just demonstrates that very, very clearly. And so I think that's probably largely what won me over, is that it's, you know, people were sort of shortcut saying like, well, it's like an 80s thing, but it's not. It wasn't just doing like a, you know, we're remaking an 80s thing. It was borrowing elements of that style to do this new hybrid thing that also had some kind of like Fincher-esque cinematography happening. And it was this really cool like vision of a horror place and coming of age stories. All these things just created this cool, I don't know. I'm coming up with a really like a stew of happiness that like you just wanted to like stew.
A witch's brew.
Yeah.
Well, that was the thing. And one of the things that still keeps me fascinated in Stranger Things is the cultural phenomenon that it really just became. And it managed to hook people who are not fans of the movies or music or things that it's referencing constantly. You know, if you did grow up in the 1980s or grew up with 1980s films, then the homages and references are going to mean something special to you. But this show managed to get a lot of people who are not fans of that kind of thing. And by that, I mean modern teens and young people who have not seen a lot of those movies and they still are really into Stranger Things. And that has fascinated me. And of course, like, we can get into it more, but just how the young stars of this show just skyrocketed to fame. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is Netflix's like billion-dollar IP. They don't, I mean, it is the number one in terms of what they can, like the marketing and the, what's the word I'm looking for? All the tie-ins and everything that that they do with it. It is the piece of intellectual property that Netflix owns that is their big thing. It's their franchise in terms of just money.
Yeah.
And who could have guessed? Like, why would modern teens and young people watch this show if they didn't live through the 80s and they don't know? I have some theories, but like, it still doesn't explain all the giant mountain of money and fame. I don't know. It's really interesting.
Well, I think there's a reason why, you know, even if we didn't grow up in the 80s, a lot of our VHS tapes and the movies that made us want to become filmmakers, even if we were growing up in the 90s, like our generation, were those Steven Spielberg 80s movies, you know, E.T., all these things that we weren't alive even when they came out or we were just born. But there's something really special about these adventure films from that time period because of what we, you know, the Duffer Brothers talk about in interviews. They're not these movies that are kids movies where it's just meant for kids, where it's kind of like nobody curses, everything's, you know, bloodless. So it's very adult, like dark, scary things happen in these films. There can be really intense gore actually for what was back then a PG film, but it also stars kids and it's about usually a group of friends and they are the protagonists. And that's something that we kind of Lost, as I think the rating system got more nuanced and there's more of a division between like these films are for kids, about kids, for kids, as opposed to films that are actually kind of more for adults or older kids that's also star kids. And I think Stranger Things brought that back. And I think that just is, that's something we were missing. You know, I think even if you didn't grow up in the 80s, there's something really fun about an adult story told through the perspective of a group of kids. And it just truly hasn't been out there as much as it once was in that kind of golden Spielberg era.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's something about references to where you have to be careful in how you do them. Like, you know, how many times have you seen a sequel and they're like, well, I don't know, I don't trust horses anymore. And it's like this joke only for people who know the previous movie really well or whatever, but it doesn't mean anything if you haven't. And I think that like Stranger Things does a really solid job of, you know, if you've seen E.T., then as soon as you see Will go out to the shed, you're like, holy crap, it's the E.T. shot, because that's a shot you see multiple times through the movie. If you don't, it's a kid going out to a shed. Like, you don't need, it's not like this shot requires you to have knowledge to appreciate it. It's just cinematography happening. It's just filmmaking happening. And same with the cast. Like, I love, you know, Winona Ryder, Matthew Modine, Paul Reiser, Sean Astin, Cary Elwes. Like, if you are someone who loves that culture of 80s movies and stuff, that means a lot to you, and it makes this thing feel like it feels like authentic, and it's a true love letter rather than just borrowing some style. But again, if you don't know who any of these people are, it's the mom, it's the creepy guy, it's whatever, you know, like, it's just these are people in the thing. Now, all that being said, 80s stuff is just kind of popular over the past decade or so, you know, and like there are kids.
Sure.
There's been a lot of nostalgia.
Right. And, you know, I think about this, like, you know, growing up in the 90s, when I see like a 15-year-old wearing a Nirvana shirt, like my first instinct is like, oh, that kid doesn't really listen to Nirvana. He just thought it was a cool thing or whatever. And I'm like, wait a minute, I listened to Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin in 1995. Like, you know, it's not, I didn't have to grow up in the 70s to appreciate that. And like my friends wore tie-dye and like bell bottoms and stuff, you know, like culture sort of come back into the picture and stuff. Dazed and Confused is one of the biggest movies of, you know, when I was in high school and stuff. So I think there is that element to it too, where it's just like the synthwave, retrowave music scene has been really popular for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
So I think that even if you didn't grow up in that time, you don't get like that true nostalgia, but you do get a sense of like, this is cool. Like, this just feels like a thing that I like right now, because this is the kind of music that have been kind of in the zeitgeist recently.
Like, one of the most interesting things to me about this whole thing, and I ended up writing a whole piece for it for Wisecrack, it was on Medium, just sort of diving into like why I think kids like Stranger Things. It doesn't surprise me that the Duffer brothers, who were born in 1984 and grew up, so they're our age essentially, and grew up, you know, not necessarily living through like the political and real lifetime of the 80s, but definitely grew up with 80s entertainment, TV and film, sort of in the way that we did in the 90s. It doesn't necessarily surprise me that they would think to create this show. And it doesn't surprise me that millennials like us and the Duffers would like it. What does surprise me, though, is that young people like it. And I do think you're onto something there, Bri, which is just this kids like things that are retro. Like, we're younger than their parents, right? Like, millennials tend not to be the parents of people who are teens now. And so I think that that's part of it. I also think that you're onto something, Alex, though, too, by just saying, you know, kids like shows that are about kids, like young protagonists who are sort of grappling with more adult problems. And it is true that it's not, there's like an irony to the way that all of this is presented a little bit, but it's not mean-spirited. It's definitely a love letter. It's made with all of this love for these things. And so you can maybe imagine modern like middle schoolers watching it and thinking, yeah, this stuff is corny and maybe it's like kind of lame in its own way. But the show is so committed to it and so loving in the way that it treats 80s like culture and nostalgia that I think it does kind of still really hook you. I don't know. What do you think, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it like you were saying, Brian, it functions whether or not you get the references. And I think also, like we're saying, the stories are about like real kid issues, like, you know,
Friendship and growing up. Yeah.
Right. Navigating high school and like sex and like pulling apart, and like it's dealing with actual like coming of age things in a not watered down way.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like against
yes.
this backdrop of a crazy sci-fi horror explosion of craziness. So I feel like there's good drama happening that pulls you in, and it's examining a story and the kinds of coming of age stories that you were saying, Alex, that we don't really get as much anymore. And it's mixed in with this like loving, fun style, like you were saying, Trisha. So I think it just has a lot of things really going for it. It doesn't require you to have like a certain point of entry. There's lots of points of entry beyond yeah. just the style. And I think that's what's really cool. And I think it's also just a really special, you know, a little bit of like a lightning in a bottle kind of thing, where like
yeah.
the cast, as we briefly mentioned, like the cast of kids is like so much fun, and like Millie Bobby Brown is cheating.
Amazing.
Like, where did she
yeah.
come from? And like Instastar, like
yeah.
yeah, it's just the way it's executed and the fun that just comes from the relationships of all the actors and the kids. It adds so much more on top of what's already a really good foundation.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, those kids look like they like ran a bunch of 80s like child movie stars through a computer and then like found
right.
and just like found four kids who just fit that. It's just like, it's weird how much they just feel like, oh, I feel like I've seen this kid in a movie 20 years ago, but that's probably not possible. But yeah, I also think that like there's something to be said for, if you look at the filmmaking, it's modern. Like they're not
yes.
trying
yes.
to
yeah, yeah, yeah.
do this sort of like, we're gonna make it look like you're watching through a VHS tape and all that kind of stuff. There are a reason we don't do certain things anymore in filmmaking. And I think that like they are borrowing from the 80s, but they're borrowing the best things, the things that still mm-hmm. feel modern and still feel sort of quote unquote correct to do. And I think like even the music, like, you know, if you look at the Safety Brothers, Good Time and Uncut Gems, like they're using 10 Tricks Point Never for their soundtracks. It's kind of a similar thing. Like this is a kind of music that we in 2020 are used to hearing. It's not like suddenly trying to do this like really wacky thing that nobody's done in a movie for 30 years. It feels like modern filmmaking, but modern filmmaking that is borrowing from a very specific era.
And it was a good call. They were originally going to try to do the monster with practical effects.
Mm.
And obviously, they just didn't have time to do mm-hmm. that. And thank goodness, because if they had really, you know, gone the like Jaws route with it, I think it would alienate modern young viewers anyway. But also, yeah, we were talking about like the young kids as the protagonist. I was trying to think of examples of like any one of these movies from the 80s that we've mentioned. So like Jaws, Close Encounters, like even something like Poltergeist and some of these more horror ones. But E.T., most of them don't have multiple generations of people to follow. So mm-hmm. you either have like the Goonies and it's really just the kids, and then they've got Josh Brolin in there, right? Who's like the older teen brother. And I guess he has like the older girls are there as well with him. So the Goonies is like maybe the nearest comp, but no one's really following the parents in the Goonies as well. That's not mm-hmm. really a part of the plot. And so to have the like sort of three different steps here where you have like the youngest group of kids, then you have the teens, but then you really have an adult like sci-fi investigation horror thing with Hop and Joyce. I feel like that is also a reason why you've got to have this. I'm sure you're just going to attract this wide audience.
When it's also what is possible in the limited series format or
yep.
whatever this is. It's kind of designed like a limited series, but it
yeah.
keeps having more seasons. But yeah, the fact that you can have 8 episodes means that you can have full-fledged stories in all those different layers that you couldn't do in a 90-minute to 2-hour film.
For sure. This episode of Beyond the Screenplay is sponsored by Mubi, the curated streaming service that premieres a new film every day. So if you've listened to any of my What Am I Watchings, you know that I love to check out films from around the world and classic movies and all kinds of things that might not otherwise end up on my radar. And for that reason, I really love Mubi, even though I actually have a lot of the other streaming services, because the movies that show up on Mubi are surprising and weird. There are really cool documentaries and foreign films, black and white films I've never heard of that have actors in them that I love, but didn't know that they made that movie. Everything about it is cool because it's just stuff that you otherwise wouldn't get to see. Each film on Mubi is handpicked. There's no algorithm. It's an amazingly eclectic selection of films from all over the world and from every time period, from old classics to new releases. So if you ever want to step outside your particular bubble of film knowledge, as I always like to do, Mubi is the perfect place to get started. And you can do so today by heading over to Mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay to get 30 days for free. It's Mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay. And thanks to Mubi for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay.
Yeah, it is interesting just the way the format of the show and how big of a role it plays, I feel like, in what Stranger Things is. Because like you were saying, Brian, House of Cards was like slightly longer seasons and still very much felt like a TV show, like just like a smaller, more focused TV show. And this, like you're saying, Alex, this felt limited series, but also felt like a it was meant to be binged. It was meant to be consumed all as one unit. And it feels like a movie. Like I think that was another thing that grabbed me about it, is that it felt like a new variation on a bunch of different familiar formats. And that was really appealing. And I think it's kind of cool how it's continued that, where each season feels like a sequel, not necessarily just like the next season. It's like a different kind of thing that they're playing with. Yeah, so it's interesting to see how it's done that, and then shows that have kind of tried to do that or not as much. But I feel like this stands as like the clean, good example of an 8-hour, 8-episode
definitely
movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I think it's been really interesting over the past 5 to 10 years to sort of follow this new way of releasing things like this. House of Cards is a good example of, I watched the first episode or two, and there were 11 more hours left, and I was like, oh, this is so much. And like, maybe like after 4 or 5 episodes, I would go, okay, now I know what I'm like rooting for and like wanting to happen, and I can keep watching. But I remember thinking at the time, if this was released once a week, I'd probably find that hour a week to watch an episode. But because there's 13 hours in front of me, I just feel like overwhelmed. Like, I don't want to. And not all the like 13 hour shows did that, but House of Cards was one where it was just, there was so much to follow. And it was, you know, it's not like Daredevil or something where it's like, well, I'm going to watch like people punch each other, so it's fun.
Yeah.
I think it's great to do, because I do appreciate being able to make this 10-hour movie, 8-hour movie, and just say, this is intended for you to watch it all at once. I mean, I still think each episode needs to be a standalone episode, but you have a lot more leeway to like leave threads open across multiple episodes. You don't have to worry, like, are they going to remember that character from 3 episodes ago? Because it hasn't been 3 weeks. You know, maybe it has, depending on who you are, obviously. But like, for most people, it won't have been multiple weeks since they watched, you know, a few episodes ago. And of course, it allows for these binging sessions. You know, like we talked about 4th of July weekend or whatever. Your friends come over, we're going to watch the new season of whatever. And, you know, like the little 4th of July party we did. And so, I mean, I love all that. And I think it's great. The downside is it keeps the show from being on your mind for months, the way a show that what we're used to with like a show starts in September and is on till May or something. I was thinking of The Walking Dead, which is like nobody watches anymore. I don't know how it's still on, but like the structure of the seasons was really interesting, because when my friends were watching, it was 8 episodes in the fall and then 8 episodes in the spring. So there would be 8 weeks where the show was on and you were wondering what's going to happen next week. And I'm on online forums and you're talking to your friends about it. And oh my God, like, who do you think's going to show up or whatever? And then the mid-season finale would have some cliffhanger. So then you've got like 2 months where you're wondering what's going to happen next. And then the season finale would have some cliffhanger. So now you've got a few months, but it's only like a few months away. It's like it ends in April and it starts in October or something. So you're like, okay, like 5-6 months, and then we get back into it. And that's cool when a show can be on your mind or on like the audience's mind for consistently for months and months and months. Now, all that being said, so that's obviously the downside to like you watch the entire season in a day and now you're done, and it's going to be a year or 2 years until between like the last episode of season 1 and the first episode of season 2. It's going to be a year. So that's the downside, obviously. But what a testament to Stranger Things that, given all of that, it still did stay in the zeitgeist. It stayed on our minds throughout the year, even when it hadn't been on in months and months. You know, I just think that's cool. But I just think it's an interesting way to look at how things are released now.
Yeah.
Well, and I think, as we've been kind of implying, Stranger Things is uniquely suited for the Netflix format, Whereas House of Cards, I don't think always was. You know, like House of Cards is not a show, depending on the season, that was necessarily that enjoyable for me to like binge six episodes in one day. Because right. It's like, can be very dense and convoluted and
it's not that fun.
Yeah. It's not always that fun. Sometimes really fun, but
yeah,
it was definitely sometimes I would watch a whole season of House of Cards and really wouldn't be able to tell you what happened for like large chunks of it, you know, because it became like a weird blur, like a binge blur. Whereas if I think I had watched some Netflix shows over time and not in that binge fashion, I actually may have retained more information because it wouldn't have been all packed into my brain in this binge session. So it's just interesting because I appreciate having access to all the episodes all at once. Like, it's just nice. But there are cultural conversations and just ongoing discussions that aren't going to be had when there's not that, like, we're all Sunday night going to sit down to watch Game of Thrones or whatever.
Right. There were definitely scenes in House of Cards where I'm like, I understand Claire's really upset about what happened, and this person's really sorry about what happened. I'm not sure what happened.
Some peace talk broke down or something, yeah, from some country.
Because I think House of Cards was enough of a TV show that they had to start making the episodes while they weren't done writing the season.
Yep. Right.
So it still had that TV show problem where they didn't know exactly what was happening. Whereas 8 is still a lot, but is more manageable to start on episode 1 and know what episode 8 is going to be and have the arc of that, you know, the movie arc spread across those 8 episodes a little bit more. And so I think that's an important distinction too. And it is interesting, I think in our Game of Thrones podcast, we talked a little bit about whether or not that final season of Game of Thrones would have been better if they just dropped it all at once. Because I think right. The cultural conversation can be really, really great, or it can right. amplify. It amplifies things in both ways.
Right.
And I think it did not do Game of Thrones any favors in that particular.
In that final season, for sure.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
But it is interesting that with Stranger Things, there is just kind of this assumption that, like, well, you're going to, by the end of this weekend, you right. are expected to have seen it. If right. you're going right. to engage in culture and things like, you know, hashtag justice for Barb can emerge mm-hmm. and like become a thing that's part of the conversation, even for this 8 episode TV series. So mm-hmm. it really is unique in its place. And I don't think there's really anything else right now that fits that right. model.
I also want to quickly shout out Orange is the New Black, which was the other like big kind of cultural phenomenon where like every year when it came on again, like I would be excited to watch it and, you know, like texting friends, like, what episode are you on? Because you couldn't have the like, did you watch last night? Cool. We can talk. It's like, wait, where you're on 4? Okay. Tell me when you're done with 6. Like,
right.
And I will say in terms of Stranger Things, even though it is each season is short, it feels like they cover so much ground mm-hmm. there. It is densely packed in. And that's one of the things that I think really hooks people. It's like what you were saying, Alex, where it doesn't take a while to get started. It gets started.
Yes.
Like the first, you know, 10 minutes of it, Will is gone. There is a mm-hmm. monster loose. The first scene is the monster is loose in this small town. It hits the ground running. Barb disappears and gets eaten by the monster at the beginning of episode 2.
Disappears at the end of 2. Yeah, and eaten
okay,
at the beginning of 3.
Okay, disappears at the end of 2. Episode 3.
It's earlier than I thought when I was rewatching it.
It moves.
Yeah.
And like I was expecting the Christmas lights, you know, when I was rewatching, you know, one of the most iconic scenes from season 1 where Joyce is talking to Will through the Christmas lights. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm pretty sure that's like in episode 7 or 8. It's in episode 4.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, which we can get into later, but not just the plot, but the development of the ideas as the premise continues to be explored. It's really quickly like explored and pushed. And this is actually less true of season 2, but seasons 1, because season 2 is more, it's really interesting. Season 2 is doing a lot of really good character work and a lot less plot than seasons 1 and 3. But seasons mm-hmm. 1 and 3 are doing a ton of plot. They're doing a ton of character work, but they're also exploring ideas, creating iconic images, and pushing the premise out and out in every single episode. They move really quickly. Like, I actually think dollar for dollar, I probably like season 3 the most, or I have the most fun watching season 3 because it is more fun. Like, it's mm-hmm. trying to be because it's the summer one. Like, it's like, oh, it's summer. We're at the pool or whatever.
Yeah.
I think it's the most polarizing.
Huh.
I feel like saying season three is your favorite is like unpopular opinion territory, but I'm kind of in the same boat with you, Trisha.
I agree. It's a lot of fun.
Interesting.
I think season three is the aliens of Stranger Things and season one is the alien. I think season three is moving more towards like action territory and is like
season two is like the alien resurrection.
I don't know what season two is.
I mean, Winona Ryder's in that one at least. So,
yeah. Anyway, it just I think it's amazing how jam packed all of the episodes are. They really right. are engaging start to finish.
Mm.
I was thinking about season two and, you know, this idea of each season is a like a sequel. And season two is doing that middle sequel thing that kind of bothers me sometimes. Where like
Temple of Doom. That thing.
Does that count? Empire Strikes Back and The Last Jedi. The idea that you have to kind of separate all your characters, like the end of the first movie is like everybody comes together. Now they're this like new family unit. And then it's like, OK, well, we need stuff to happen now. So break it apart. Send everybody in different directions. Mm. Elle is off doing her thing. And she kind
of
like
angry.
That one episode where she
season two, episode seven. Get it out of here.
So it's weird because like I think it's an interesting episode, but it feels like an episode of a television series. Like it feels out of step. Mm, right. Yeah. And it does feel out of step in that format of Stranger Things that we're talking
about. Like there's not bottle episodes in like a big movie.
No.
Right. You know, just go away for 20 minutes and do a whole other thing and then come back.
But I do appreciate that it has taken the risk to make each season different. So it would have been easy to make season two just feel like more of the same, but instead they did what you were talking about. They introduced new characters, they make people be separated and stuff. And then if your whole thing about your show is like, we're going to release it in October and it's like Halloween-y mm-hmm. and dark, like how ballsy to be like, actually season three is going to be released on 4th of July and it's going to be about like a fair, you know? And I just think like that was so cool just to have the aesthetic of your show, the underlying aesthetic is the same, but the surface aesthetic is totally just like more daylight and more just like fun and running around and that kind of thing. And I just think you may not like every choice they make, but I certainly think it's better than just trying to like hang on to the thing that you did last time and just try to do it again, but now there's more of them or now it's bigger or whatever, you know.
The pool setting in season three turns out to be really menacing. And it's a really, again, that interesting, unconventional setting for a horror thing. I don't know. It reminds me of our conversation about Jaws when like the chaos of the brightly lit beach and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, having this like community pool that, you know, reminds me of The Sandlot and, you know, other movies from that era of like kids playing in the pool. Then to have Billy in the third season, you know, be possessed and it imbues the setting with a lot of menace and same thing with like the county fair and the mall. It is really cool. Season three is just kind of veering into like literal new territory in terms of settings and where things can happen. Whereas season one and season two feel very similar where it's all in the buyer's house. It's all in, you know, it's all in Mike's basement. It's all in the woods and the Hawkins lab. And everything. And then even season three, like one of my favorite things in season three is the set piece in the hospital with Nancy and Jonathan getting chased around by their bosses from the newspaper who are, you know, possessed by the Mind Flayer. It's really interesting to see season two does like a deepening of what season one is, whereas season three makes a sharp turn. And like you're saying, Brian, that's a really interesting, brave, cool choice. At that point, I've looked and looked. I cannot find the budget for season three. It's not on the internet and it's driving me crazy because it's so obvious they had so much money by comparison to the first two seasons. Like season one, they had the budget of like about $6 million an episode, $5-6 million per episode of season one. Season two is about $8 million per episode. And no one has published the budgets of season three, but you can just tell they're astronomical.
That's how big. I mean, they built a mall.
Oh my gosh. Right? Well, they converted a mall. But yeah. Mm. Anyway.
And I like that it's they still ground it to character development things also. So it's like it takes place at a mall. Like that's one of our central places. And so there's you know, the background and the cultural changing of America and all the things that are like commenting mm-hmm. there. But it's also like the kids are teenagers and they want to go to the mall and like, you know, get their hair done and like they have summer jobs and like all these things that I feel like the settings match the evolution and growth of, you know, our heroes as they're slowly inching their way toward adulthood or whatever.
Yeah, they're not going to go back to the arcade at that point.
Right. Yeah. And so it just feels like a really good setting for the interpersonal drama to be taking place at, as well as a really cool setting to have like monsters chasing you. And
in the mall.
Yeah. Malls are fun to blow up. What's that? I hear a knocking on my door.
Yeah. I don't want to like rag on season three too much, but just to offer kind of what I found that didn't work for me about season three was I felt like in the second half of the season, I really enjoyed the turns it took and the new settings and the teenager stuff and the new kind of like colors and color palette and daylight. I did feel like the Russian base and like the like kind of almost like screwball comedy of Winona Ryder and Hooper, like and what's Winona Ryder's name in the show?
Joyce.
The kind of screwball comedy of like Joyce and Hopper, like it kind of wore on me. Like I was kind of exhausted. Like they were bickering for so many episodes in such like an almost over the top way. And then it's like, you love each other, actually. It didn't feel as honest to me as season one. Where like, in season one, it still felt like, even though we're doing a slightly heightened reality, we're doing crazy government experiments, and we're doing all these, you know, fun 80s things, it still felt very grounded. And the emotions felt grounded. And I really understood all the characters' motivations and where they're coming from. In season three, it felt a bit more showy. It's like, we're just kind of like doing stuff. And it's going to be loud and big and, you know, we're going to have these characters yell at each other for no reason for like five episodes straight. And I think that is where I kind of got like a little bit fatigued by the show. Whereas season one, and then season two is a little murky in my mind, but season one especially, I think I was so captivated because it was doing all of these things at once. It was a kind of a grounded drama at the same time as being a heightened retro sci-fi horror. And season three felt a little bit shallower for me in that way, where it just got into the wacky Russian adventure and the wacky all this stuff. So that was that was kind of where I bumped for season three, and why by the end of it I was kind of like, that was a lot, and I'm, you know, it's over now and that was a fun finale, but I'm not sure that I like enjoyed the ride every step of the way the same way I had in previous seasons.
Yeah, I think that's fair, and I don't disagree. I also think it's one of those things where once they got you, they got you. And
if, yeah,
and that works for some people and not for everybody. But like for me, I was just like, I'm kind of happy for Stranger Things to do like literally whatever it wants. I'm just going to have fun with it. And that doesn't mean I'm going to argue that the choices are good or that, you know, that everyone should like it or anything like that. But I do think that this show did strike that right chord with me where I'm like, look, when Dusty Bun and Susie Poo start singing Neverending Story, I started bawling. I was like, this is the most beautiful moment ever. And it's so stupid. It's like literally they're being chased by this giant monster and you have Hopper and Joyce or like Joyce like turns her head and she like face palms basically.
Yeah.
But I'm just like, this is the most gorgeous thing I've seen on a show in forever. And I'm so happy. But again, like it's tonally bizarre to suddenly in this like very dire, we all might die moment, we're going to have like a little musical number. So I agree with you, Alex, that it is more showy and less grounded. But it's also one of those things where I'm just like, you took this chance that I was going to love this and I did, and not everyone's going to. But like those are the moments that can be the most beautiful sometimes is when you do that thing that for 20% of your audience, they're going to lose their minds.
Well, it's a bit of a tightrope walk in terms of actually hitting the emotional core of the characters here, because obviously the show is doing sci-fi and action and horror, and it doesn't leave a lot of, often those genres don't leave a lot of room for like real character moments, you know, when it comes to themes like family and death and like, I don't know, just thinking about the running story of the death of Hopper's little girl prior to the start of the show and how, you know, Eleven comes to be this role. That's like a really complex, you know, grief, like is a huge part of that, and the unhealthy coping mechanisms that we see from some of the adult characters, and the real life growing pains that the kids go through. So thinking about in the first season, when they find what they think is Will's body in the quarry, and how really emotional that is, even though we as the audience know that he's not dead, and we believe in Joyce, and we know that the upside down is a thing, and we know that there's a monster, and we know that Eleven is here, and we trust that Will didn't just get lost and accidentally fall into a quarry and drown, because that's really dark. I feel like that is a really perfect encapsulation of where the show kind of goes at its best, where it's able to hit on this like human darkness and this human drama, in addition to being about all of this, like, you know, extraterrestrial or sci-fi or whatever stuff. And season three, because it is playing so fast and loose with a lot of the like cultural, I don't know, I was going to say zings and zaps. I'm not even sure what that means.
That sounds right for season three.
But right? Yeah. Isn't that how season three feels? It's got all those zings and zaps in it. But in as much as it's hitting all of those as hard as it can, and doing the thing you're talking about with, like, it's the funniest season easily, right? It's just sort of the goofiest season. And when it tries to hit, goes to those dark places with Billy, when Billy's like a kid on the beach, and you know, Billy is the victim of abuse, and that's why he, like, abuses the people in his life, and that stuff. That's a little bit, I mean, it's just, it's a really hard tightrope to walk. So, and I feel like they mostly pull it off. But it is, you're getting closer and closer to the edge of, like, what is corny and, like, what is real. And that actually keeps me emotionally hooked in here.
Right.
And I think that there's some of that, probably the forgiveness that I extend to creators that are having to make sequels to their beloved perfect things comes into play here, because there isn't a ton of room to keep expanding. I like, even at the end of the first season, I was like, well, where are they gonna go with this? Like, what can happen next? And season two, you know, leans on the character development a lot more, and so it's more about, like, them, and that kind of evolves and introduce new characters, and that complicates things, and that's cool. And I think for me with season three, I kind of appreciated that they communicated to me as a viewer anyway, that we're not going to worry too much about the logistics of, is this all going to make sense and plug in, because it doesn't and it won't. So we're going to have...
We got the rats. We got the bodies. We got the meat monster. Right. Made of all the bodies.
Like, if you start thinking about any of it too hard, it doesn't super duper make sense.
Nope.
And so I appreciate that they're like, well, we're going to have fun, at least, like, we're going to keep enough of that there that it's, you know, compelling, and then we're going to kind of double down on the stuff that we know we can keep expanding on and playing with, and watching those characters evolve and grow up is ultimately the thing I feel like I care about more at this point anyway than, like, the upside down and the swirly smoke monster slash goo
and the Russians
monster and their Russians now also
the evil, like, Russians.
Yeah.
A very un-nuanced look at some, at some evil Russians, which made sense in 1985 and kind of doesn't now.
I mean, it's the very much the, like, 80s Russians, you know. Yeah, right, I guess they can get away with it because they're doing the retro 80s thing.
Yeah, it's Red Dawn, basically.
And kind of Rocky IV and kind of the Terminator, like, weirdly.
Right.
Right, yeah. Season 3 has, like, the Terminator guy.
Yeah.
One of the things you were saying earlier, Trisha, about season 1 and how they waste no time and every episode is, like, pushing the world further and further. Like, they pack so much into each season. They don't leave a lot of stuff, you know, for the future. Like, it's like they're telling a full story right now, right here. And even season two, it was kind of funny how it's like poor Will is just once again the vessel for the upside down. Like, he becomes like basically a body through which, like, dark stuff happens.
That kid is so good.
Yeah,
he is.
But
everyone is.
Yeah, it's like season one is such a perfect package. You know, it's a full, complete movie that has everything I want in this kind of movie. And so it's hard. It's like, yeah, there probably is no sequel that's going to please me because season one already gave me exactly what I wanted. And so every sequel is now going to be something else, kind of a spinoff on whatever the origin was, but it's not going to be the thing that I definitely 100% love through and through, which is season one. Mm-hmm. So that's just what it is. And I can appreciate and enjoy these weird spinoff worlds as they keep going, because they're going to keep going.
Yeah. It's interesting. Season two becomes almost like an Exorcist version of like a horror movie instead of, I mean, it's still definitely a monster thing because they have this demodogs that are everywhere.
The demodogs.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I guess that's what I mean when I say that season three is like the Aliens, where the mystery part is kind of gone. Mm-hmm. Like, there's not really a mystery now about the Upside Down. What is it? What lives there? We know it's the Mind Flayer. It's totally evil. And we also know the way to beat it. You close the gate. Like, there's one way to do it.
They keep closing it.
To close the damn gate.
Right. They just keep closing the gate.
So, yeah, that's what I mean, I guess, you know, just agreeing with what you guys are saying. Season three is a different thing because the mystery part is gone. So they really are just kind of turning up the, let's have fun watching the characters that we know, like meet this new challenge, but not, there's not the same sort of like creeping dread or horror kind
right.
of. They turn up the gore in a way that I think is interesting with that meat monster.
Yeah, man. Yeah. A lot of meat going around.
So much of it. but yeah, it definitely isn't treading on the same like hair standing up on the back of your neck thing that season one and season two are really, really great at.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I was thinking about is just like, how do you manage a cast of characters that's this big? And I think that's...
Well, you split them up.
Right. You split them up. And then I wonder if it's like at some point you need to kind of start pruning. Like I'm wondering if season four, we're going to kind of like lose some people along the way, because that was one of the things for me in season three that was hard, is that I felt like I was tracking a lot of people, and occasionally there were scenes where it was like, I don't think everyone has something to do in this scene. Like I think some people are just here to be here because they have to be somewhere on screen.
Right.
And then like, you know, introducing Maya Hawke's character Robin was awesome. Like, she's great. Like, she and Steve have a ton of fun, but it's like, hey, now there's another person. And then like Lucas's sister is now also here. And like,
and
now Dustin has so there's like, it's fun. And I think all the additions add things. At a certain point, it's too much to hold. So I'm curious to see how you do that.
That's part of the fatigue, I think, I felt, you know, I think it was just like, the show's asking me to be invested in yet more relationships and more characters. And I think I was just growing a little bit weary. It's like, this is just expanding outward and outward. Where does it end?
Well, it is the imperative of having this like sort of big, essentially ensemble cast. And the thing about season one is that they're able to, because no one knows what's happening, but everyone's invested in the mystery of what happened to Will in different ways. The show doesn't have to do any work to split them up. They're naturally split. And then it brings them together at the climax. Season two has to do the work to split them up. And as we talked about, it does feel like work, right? Where they're, where Nancy and Jonathan like go off to meet Murray and like expose what happened to Barb, and which is great, you know, but then you have to split the different characters off, and it starts to feel like they're being moved around on a board. Season three feels even more like that. So part of me does wonder if season four, because half the characters moved away to a different town at the end of season three, if we might be following both sets of people that are still in Hawkins and people that are not, the Byers and Elle who moved away, and then we'll just be following them separately, and then they may, you know, something involving the Upside Down is going to like bring him back, or the Russians, or, you know, Hop, because he's over there. He's way over there. And so we're going to have to bring him together for that. But, you know, it is like, as much as it is, it's just smart narrative work actually to split him up and to lay the groundwork. If you pretty much know at that point you're going to have a season four, which the Duffers did, because Netflix wanted to shoot season three and four back to back. To keep the kids young.
Interesting. Right.
They are getting pretty old at this point.
Right. So, you know, but I actually think it was the right call. The Duffers really wanted to get season three right and spend the time developing the story and shooting it and making, you know, not splitting their focus with season four. It is smart to lay the groundwork with season four, by splitting all the characters up at the end of season three. I don't, I would be very surprised if at the beginning of season four, they're just all in the same place again.
Sure.
I'd be even more shocked if that place is Hawkins, because I feel like we're going to spend a decent amount of time outside of Hawkins in the next season.
Exhausted Hawkins quite a bit at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, I love Hawkins, but
the world can only end so many times there.
right.
For real.
Do you ever find yourself listening to our show and feeling like you want to chime in?
Yes.
Maybe you want to share your thoughts on Kurosawa with Brian, or pick on movies that aren't fun enough with Alex, or nerd out about historical fiction with Trisha, or simply tell me that all my opinions are correct and should be taken as fact.
Wow.
Whatever it is, you can now do exactly that. Our highest tier on the Beyond the Screenplay Patreon lets you join our monthly film club video chat. Each month, the four of us join a group of patrons to chat about movies. Recent topics have included The Matrix and Jaws and Christopher Nolan's filmography. There was a lot of opinions on that one.
Yes, there were.
There were. And actually, the discussion made me want to revisit Dunkirk, which I never thought I would want to do.
Wow.
So it's lots of fun. Patrons join the chat from all over the country and all over the world. We've had people join from South Africa and Sweden and Australia. There are also patrons of all ages, from adults with kids to literal kids. You know who I'm talking about. Yes, you. I know you're listening. I don't remember exactly how old you are, but you're too young to be a person. Anyway, it's a lot of fun. It lets us truly get to know you better and vice versa. And it really, really helps support the show. So head to the Beyond the Screenplay Patreon to join our monthly film club video chat. We hope to see you soon. Awesome. Well, why don't we go around and say what lessons we're going to take away from Stranger Things. Brian, do you want to start us off?
Sure. There's the quote that you guys had found from the Duffer Brothers that annoyed me, which was that not them annoying me, but the circumstance annoyed me, which was they said they took Stranger Things to different networks and the networks kept saying, like, well, is this a kids thing or is it this adult horror thing? It can't be both. Which, first of all, I'm like, do you even 80s, bro? But like, it annoys me that they're sort of like trying to fit things into these little boxes, you know, like, oh, it has to be this kind of thing. And I was just thinking, like, think about whenever you see a billboard for like Gerard Butler and Gabrielle Union in Dire Consequences or Deadly Threat or, you know, Precarious Corridor, whatever. Like, it's just like, you know, what's Netflix's new thing? Project Power, you know, and it's just like, and you look at that and you're just like, this looks like a bad version of a movie I've seen 100 times before. Like, this doesn't look like anything new. Why would I bother? And of course, some people do want that. Some people want to see the same thing over and over again. And that's fine, I guess. But like, generally speaking, it's not the next great thing. It's like, you know, that movie you saw last year, we did it again with different premise, but and different actor. It's like, nobody wants that. But then now think about every time you discover something you love and you're trying to explain it to somebody, all you end up doing is you talk about the multiple things it's like, how it's kind of like this, but also like this. So, you know, if you're going like, it's kind of like if David Fincher made a James Bond movie, but set in a dystopian science fiction future. Michael, check. Trisha, check. Alex, check. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but you know what I mean? It's like you're always going like, oh, it's kind of like the cool thing that we love about this, but also the cool thing we love about this. And it just annoyed me that the networks were like, it can't be multiple things. It has to be one simple thing. And it's like, screw you. Granted, sometimes movies can be too many things at once. I've definitely walked out of movies where I'm like, it was trying to be too many things. So you have to find that balance and you have to make sure that there is cohesion between these elements. But ultimately, my lesson is like, don't settle for making the same thing someone else has already made. Make the thing that feels uniquely you and borrows from the things that you love. And if the studio or network says it has to be just one of those things, throw waffles in their face.
Find your Netflix.
That's good career advice. Yeah. Yeah. Always bring waffles to your pitch meetings.
In case you have to throw them in the producer's face.
In case you have to pitch them in the producer's
face.
I don't know why the Stranger Things theme kicks in there, but it just felt right.
It's the mic drop. Awesome. Alex, what about you?
So we kind of mentioned this earlier. Brian, you mentioned this about how they didn't shoot this show as if it was shot in the 80s. You know, they didn't use 80s technology. They didn't, because that is a thing. There's like two different versions of this retro wave where it's like, we're literally going to make a thing look like it's 30 years old, like, or 40 years old intentionally. We're going to take our like better film stock we have today and like muddy it up in post to make it look worse because we love what it looked like in the 80s. And there's a time and a place for that. Like there's some fun like music videos or just like there are reasons to do that. I think that it's so much more interesting and so much more engaging and entertaining to do what the Duffer Brothers did, which is they managed to make a thoroughly modern show that is their own style, that is their own voice, while integrating mm-hmm. their nostalgia for this era of film. And I think that's just so much more interesting and so much more accessible. There's things like we talked about in our rants for patrons on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. There were elements of that film that really only had meaning if you were clued into the cultural or mm-hmm. the references that were being made in that film. They were essentially meaningless if you did not have access to those references. Mm-hmm. Whereas this film has all those references, or film series, but it feels like a film. Stranger Things has all those references built in for people like the Duffers who love that era of cinema. But you don't have to know a single reference. I'm pretty sure my husband doesn't know a single reference in this series, but he loves Stranger Things. And it's because it's a thoroughly modern, entertaining, great show. Yeah. So I think it's just a great lesson because I think there's so many people that do have a nostalgia for the 80s and 90s, especially in our generation. And I think there's a temptation to just think that if I make a thing, like there is some kind of value in just making something look like it was made in that time. And I think it's much more interesting to do what the Duffer Brothers did and much more enjoyable by much more people than just people who are also as nostalgic as you are for a very particular thing.
Yeah, there's like a thing that happens sometimes where someone will say, I'll say like, I'm not a big fan of musicals. And they're like, oh, well, you should see this musical because it's a parody of a musical. Like it does all the bad things. And I'm like, so you're saying it's still a bad musical? And they're like, yeah, but it's funny. And I'm like, right, but I don't want to watch that, like where you're trying so hard to be the thing that you just end up being the thing. And I'm like, right, but if I don't like the first thing, I'm not going to like the...
Right.
So yeah, it's exactly what you're saying.
And I feel like that's how you push the medium forward also. Like,
right.
I think that's probably what irks me sometimes. It's like, well, we already did that. Like, let's not just do it again. Let's find a cool way to identify what was great about that and apply it to where we are now and like take a step forward.
It's like if I want to watch a movie that looks like it was made by Steven Spielberg in the 80s, I can probably just go watch a Steven Spielberg movie made in the 80s and it would probably be better.
We have
right.
those.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a self-awareness to Stranger Things that makes it
right.
palatable. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And just once again, a modern sensibility from the music to the editing to the cinematography. Like it's not pretending like this was made 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, this is a tangent for another time, but I've been thinking a little bit about the 80s and the nostalgia thing. And there does seem to be a weird kind of cyclical, a lot of the things that began in the 80s have reached their full maturity now. And so like the sort of synthy electronic music that was in then that was new, like is like, we're still doing that. Like there's still a place for like that. I guess it's the technology that began in the 80s that influenced a lot of culture has reached its maturity now-ish along with kind of our generation. And so like video games and music and like camera technology and like all these things have kind of all like matured. And I feel like that also lends just like an extra specialness, I think, of like why the throwback to the 80s stuff works so well.
It's like the origin
right now.
The origin of all the things that are such a part of our lives
in some ways. Yeah, but maybe that's just because I was born in 86 and that's what I think. I don't know. Trisha, what's your lesson?
All of this actually ties into my lesson, which is sort of about the iconography of American cinema. Ooh. I like said it anyway. But
I was thinking it. Yeah,
good. It's interesting what you guys were just talking about has to reminded me just of the decade of the 1980s, 70s and 80s, but really how cinema was basically being, American cinema especially, was being dramatically reshaped by, you know, particular filmmakers. And we've talked a decent amount about blockbusters and what those looked like and meant, and high concept movies and what those looked like and meant. And so that's really what people were studios were spending their money on in the 1980s. And the thing about a high concept movie is it has this iconography to it. A high concept movie is supposed to be condensable into one sentence and sort of digestible in an iconic image. And so when you think about E.T., what you essentially see is a bicycle against the moon, right? Mm-hmm. Spielberg is great at this. He's like maybe, you know, one of the best ever. It's a shark fin in the water. It's just a striking, iconic image. And Stranger Things is really good at doing that. The Duffers did a spectacular job at lifting these images and often in the same way that Spielberg did, which is take something familiar to us and put it somewhere new or make it like dark or sinister. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's the thing about a bicycle against the moon is that a bicycle is not supposed to be in the sky. It's an object that's instantly recognizable, but where it is awakes our imagination. And the Duffers are great at this.
Christmas lights.
Christmas lights. Exactly that.
Waffles, blonde wigs, yes. And pink dresses. Like you put those three things together, done.
A baseball bat with nails through it. Right. It's right. Like they do a really, really good job of knowing how to put the ingredients together to make an iconic image. And it has to do with that mixture of familiarity and like newness. That being said, I won't spend too long on this, but I also think that's the same reason that the redemption of Steve Harrington is one of the best things about this show, because they introduce him as something familiar and then they lift him out of that into newer places and newer places. His role starts to like shift in a really iconoclastic way, where he's moving into different spaces, where he starts off as just this douchebag boyfriend, that jock that we're supposed to hate. And then he moves in season two to be like this completely different, unexpected character and ally. Even by the end of season one, he's doing something different. And I think when you think about what shows and big high concept movies do at their best, they give you shorthand for something that you recognize, and then they put it somewhere totally that you don't expect it. And I feel like they do that the Duffers do that with images. They do it with characters as well. Steve's the best example of it that I can think of.
Well, rewatching season one, I also appreciate that Steve is like, yes, he's a dick, and yes, he's that douchebag boyfriend, but like he is like, there are moments where he is caring and there are moments where he's smart. And that, so it's not this complete 180 to turn him into like a good guy later on, because right. It feels like he isn't just this two-dimensional like douchey boyfriend, that he is just there so we can have, you know, Jonathan punch him in the face at the end and run away with Nancy or something like that. You know, he's there. He's more of a real well-rounded character.
Yeah. And I do wonder, I know that the Duffers have said that the roles were being cast as they were writing. And so that the young actors, especially that they ended up casting, did bleed back into the roles, or they helped to shape where the characters went. I wonder how much Joe Keery and just how charismatic and interesting he is, like managed to affect what happened to Steve Harrington throughout the course of this series. But yeah, it's really interesting. And that spirit of the 1980s, I feel like that's what's coming through.
Yeah, for sure. And his chemistry with the kids, especially Dustin. It's just, so good.
Yeah. What a joy. Like,
let them go. Let them go and be extremely entertaining.
Yeah.
My lesson is sort of, we talked about earlier, of this idea of having storylines with different groups of characters that span these different ages. Like, I think the more we've talked about that, the more I've realized that that is a really interesting thing that not a lot of shows do. So we, you know, you have the adults and the teens and the kids. And a good friend of mine just finished watching Dark last night, and so I was talking to him about Dark. And I think that's one of the things about Dark that made it feel a little Stranger Things-y in some ways, because there is like the adult storyline and like what they're dealing with and how hard it is to be a parent and all these things. And then you have the kids in high school and they're dealing with high school things, and all of them are dealing with time travel. And that's kind of like the Stranger Things too, where they,
right,
each of these groups has their own kind of immediate concerns, and they're all tied together through this bigger concern. And I think that that's just a really cool mechanism for creating different kinds of drama that can, yeah, go to different places when you need it to. Like, you can use one to create levity when other things are really serious. And I don't know, I think it's a cool dramatic setup to give yourself when creating a story, especially something that is ensemble like this that's going to go on for episodes and episodes. Like, it's just a rich grab bag of characters to have. So
definitely.
Yeah. Why don't we go around and say what we've been watching recently? Trisha, going back the other way.
I've been on a kick recently where I've been watching a lot of...
Let's hear it. What's the kick?
Oh, hold on. Can we guess?
Psychological thrillers?
Oh,
that's what I was going to guess. So.
Yeah.
I love how it's always at least like three adjectives to describe like the binge that you're on currently.
Thank you so much. Yeah. So I've been watching a lot of these from recent years. So like in the last... two, three years, movies that have come out that are kind of set in Europe, usually with European actors, and are doing like a psychological thriller thing. But the best one that I've seen, or I don't know, just one of the most interesting ones that I've seen, is a movie that actually came out in 2020 called The Burnt Orange Heresy. It came out, God bless it, March 8th of 2020. poor this movie, by an Italian filmmaker named Giuseppe Capotondi. Let's go with that. Starring Elizabeth Debicki and Donald Sutherland.
Wow.
And a Danish actor named Klaus Bang and Mick Jagger.
What?
Of course.
And it's like an art, like forgery, heisty kind of thriller. It's very Talented Mr. Ripley, which is definitely my jam. It's just kind of an interesting modern take on this genre. You know, it's just got this really small cast. It's really contained. It's basically, it basically all takes place at Mick Jagger's castle in Europe. And he plays this eccentric art collector.
Okay.
He plays an eccentric art collector. So essentially he does play himself. But anyway, I just thought it was really interesting. And if you like this kind of, yeah, psychological thriller where everyone's a con man, maybe, and everyone has like hidden motives and there's all of this art and no one really knows, you know, there's a debate about what is forgery and what is genius and what does it mean to be perceived by the public as being a genius? And there's all these different, you know, motives and everything like that. I don't know. It's just, it's a really interesting movie that I liked and felt it. It's certainly not perfect, but didn't deserve to get buried under COVID all the way as much as it did.
Sounds like a movie Michael would like.
Yeah.
March 8th is also my dad's birthday. So I think there was a lot of attention put to that too.
It definitely got lost in the celebration of your dad's birthday, Brian.
Alex, what have you been watching?
So we've been watching the Netflix docuseries Challenger, The Final Flight.
Ooh.
About the Challenger explosion. Very interesting, especially, you know, it happened like, I think it was like the year before I was born. It was, it's such a fascinating look at what that cultural moment was, because up until that disaster, there was this amazing like acceleration of spaceflight, and we're going to send up, you know, hundreds of flights per year. We're going to start taking civilians up into space. Like, there really was this vision of like a spacefaring future just right around the corner. And, you know, this was this moment that was highly publicized because they had a teacher, a civilian teacher, on board the Challenger for the first time ever. So it was one of the most widely watched of those like mid-80s launches.
Yeah.
And the trauma of that event is like such a cultural moment. So yeah, for somebody who wasn't, you know, alive and conscious during that cultural moment, it was really interesting to kind of see the context around it and also get the human story of the astronauts that were on the Challenger. So not, you know, not like a fun watch, but really interesting and really good context for like what happened to our aspirations to be kind of the space-faring civilization. People were talking about up until that launch of like, kids have to be educated about space because they're all going to be on space stations like when they're adults. Like, people were really optimistic about the future of space travel. And this, and just shows how one moment can change everything. Mm-hmm. So very interesting.
Brian, what about you? What have you been watching?
I will see Alex's Netflix docuseries and raise him a high score appropriately to Stranger Things.
I have watched that.
Wow, nice.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's about the history of video games.
Correct. Trisha, why don't you tell everyone what I've been watching?
Trisha, you watched a thing about video games?
I did. It's really cool. Brian, tell him about it.
I will. I'm excited. Yeah, it's about the sort of the origin of the video game industry, like creation of Space Invaders, Pac-Man, Doom, the Nintendo Sega War, like all that kind of like early 90s, late 80s kind of thing. And it's really fun and quirky. Like, it's very unashamed of just having fun with, like, they'll get the interviewees to like do little skits and stuff. And it's like awkward, but in just an adorable way. And they do these retro graphic montages that are so cool. Mm-hmm. So someone will be telling a story about like, well, I had to go to Japan and da da da. And then you see what I thought was like, I'm watching footage from a video game, but it's like, oh no, they made this like super NES style montage to show this guy going off on whatever adventure he's telling you a story about, which is just really cool. And it does a really surprising and cool representation thing too, where it's like, highlights a lot of people from different like marginalized communities and shows the impact they've had on the birth of the video game industry, which was like just kind of like totally unexpected. You're like, oh, okay, I'm going to watch a bunch of like old white and Japanese men doing this thing. And suddenly you're like, oh, here's this like trans woman who won the Space Invaders thing, and this gay black man who like had this huge impact on, you know, it's just like, it was really neat to see that kind of, and of course they talk about how, what it means to them to like be able to play a game and sort of see themselves, mm-hmm. you know, represented, or see them, or be able to sort of like escape from like issues they're having and that kind of thing. So yeah, that was just really sweet and unexpected. And then as a digestif, we watched The Wizard, the 1989 movie with Fred Savage, Jenny Lewis, Christian Slater, Beau Bridges, about a child video game prodigy who travels to California to compete in this big tournament, which, a movie I had on VHS and loved as a kid. And my girlfriend and I were both like 10 times during high score. We're like, oh, it's like The Wizard. Oh my God, this is like the exact scene in The Wizard. So after we're done, we're like, should we watch The Wizard? Yeah. And it's basically a giant commercial for Nintendo, but I don't care. It's like, it actually surprisingly held up for me. Like, it's actually an engaging movie that's not terrible. Like, it didn't have the best reviews or anything, but I'm like, no, this holds up. I care about these characters. I'm totally on this journey. So I was very surprised at how watchable that was. So go watch High Score and then watch The Wizard immediately afterward, and it will blow your mind.
Amazing. That's really funny.
Michael, what are you watching?
So I recently revisited The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, and mm-hmm. I did so for my guest appearance on our good friend Sean Eastridge's show Missing Frames, that we have now all been on multiple times, where you go and... Thus far, it had been, he makes me watch a movie that I haven't seen before, which was The Exorcist. Yes, which was actually not that bad ultimately, but I was apprehensive going into it. So for this one, this was like the one David Fincher film he hadn't seen. And it's kind of culturally known as like the bad David Fincher film. And I've always liked it. I've never upheld that it's a perfect movie by any means, but it's one of those things where I feel like I watch it and have an experience, and then I hear from other people that watched it, and I'm thinking, like, did we watch the same movie? Like, why do people hate this so passionately? Anyway, so it was a very cathartic conversation, I will say, that I had with Sean, and it was cool to have him go into the movie with an open mind and talk about it and all the themes that it explores and why I think it's really special in the Fincher filmography. And like, I was basically trying like not to cry the whole time. So like, it was a really enjoyable, cathartic, emotional conversation for me anyway. So we'll have the link to that in the show notes. But
made me want to watch the movie again just so I can listen to your podcast.
I feel like we should have a conversation about the themes that explores and kind of frame it a little bit and then go and revisit it.
Oh, it has to be framed before I can watch it.
Apparently.
I don't think you have to, right. But I think it helped Sean. I think the way we talked about it before he went and watched it on the show kind of helped.
Okay. So you groomed him to like it.
No, not at all. I think I groomed him to have an open mind.
Cool.
Which I think is important.
Huh. That's good.
Also, Panic Room is the bad David Fincher movie.
I love Panic Room. Brian.
It's so much fun.
All right. More conversations about bad David Fincher movies. If they exist, do they exist? Stay tuned, everybody.
Well, this has been our conversation about Stranger Things. Beyond the Screenplay is produced by Vince Major. Our editor is Eric Schneider. I've been joined today by the Lessons from the Screenplay team, Trisha Arand, Brian Bittner, and Alex Calleros. I am Michael Tucker. You can find all of our Twitter handles in the show notes. feel free to reach out and say hello. Thank you to all the patrons who support the show and make it possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.